Welcome to Insider's Guide to Energy Stories. We hope you enjoy finding out more about the personal journeys of your colleagues and their journey through the energy industry. Now, sit back and enjoy this week's episode.
This episode of Insider's Guide to Energy Stories is sponsored by Vedectus. For more information, please go to www.vedectus.com.
Hello and welcome to the Insider's Guide to Energy Stories podcast episode. I'm here with Ricardo Ridolfi. Ricardo, thank you very much for joining me. How are you doing?
Hi, William. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm doing very well, thank you. Fine day in Kampala.
Yeah, so you've joined us from a restaurant in Kampala, Uganda, which is fantastic. Very glad that you could make the time for us. You are the CEO and co-founder of a company called Equatorial Power, but you're also a board member at Umeme, which is the largest electricity distributor in Uganda. You do plenty else besides. Would you give us a little summary of kind of what your roles are and where they are?
Yes, William, thanks for that. So to be succinct, I mean, my day-to-day is running Equatorial Power, which I'll love to tell you a bit more about. As you've mentioned correctly, I sit on the board of Umeme, so Uganda's national electricity distribution company. I also sit on the board of a company called Axian Energy, which is based out of Madagascar and is investing really in the energy transition across Africa. And then I'm involved in a couple other initiatives around productive asset financing and solar commercial and industrial plants, all to do with sort of energy transition on the African continent. But again, the bulk of my day is gladly spent running Equatorial Power.
Yeah, cool. Thanks very much for that introduction. So diving straight into your work at Equatorial Power, I'm keen to hear what the mission is there, what the problem is that you're trying to solve.
Absolutely. So, you know, without going back to Adam and Eve, I think it's common knowledge that something like 1.2 to 1.3 billion people worldwide do not have access to electricity whatsoever form today. Roughly half of that number is in Africa alone. And Africa is projected, due to demographic growth, to not be able to solve that problem at business as usual terms today. So Equatorial Power is one among the pioneering companies on the continent. We have many laudable peers that have set upon the mission to try and contribute towards accelerating energy access. I would go a little step further in terms of what we see ourselves as doing, what we see our DNA as being a little bit different to the crowd, and that is that we don't really care much about electricity itself. We think that energy access is the best enabler, ultimately, to development and under a business perspective, to the offering of services to customers. So Equatorial Power really is a decentralized energy infrastructure company for services. And this is, you know, double emphasized because you're talking about over 600 million people in Africa alone that today are largely not reached by any infrastructure and most service providers, I suppose telecoms being the only exception. These are customers that have the means to pay for basic services. And I think one important realization, and this sounds like sounds tautological, but you realize when you operate in these markets that it's extremely expensive to be poor, right? I mean, I'm sure, William, I'm sure you don't know what percentage of your income you spend in electricity and water. Right, I probably don't know that either.
No.
And the truth is, we always take this for granted, right? But if you're living in rural Africa today, on average, you're spending between 20 and 30% of all your income in just water and electricity, or wow, a substitute of electricity, rather. So whether that's a diesel genset electricity or kerosene or candles, but that's a huge sum, right? And then you have to eat, and then you have to do everything else. God forbid you get sick or have school fees to pay. So the point I'm trying to make is that there is already an important substitution effect in terms of offering a better service for a better rate to all these people who can already pay. So that is the first step, right? When you realize that, then you realize that, wow, if I can now deliver this service and deliver it in a sustainable manner, in a way that's affordable and abundant, that being the key, hence our emphasis not on electricity itself, but what you do with the electricity. So we work with a company called Energrow, which does productive asset financing, right? And our biggest joint venture partner is ENGIE. ENGIE, you know, one of maybe the largest IPP on earth. So with ENGIE Energy Access, we are really pioneering a model where we focus on the use, the productive use. So Equatorial Power, together with ENGIE Energy Access, we invest in, yes, the generation and the distribution, but we also invest in processing, in water purification, in ice making, in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. And partners like Energrow come alongside and do business incubation and productive asset financing for the customer. Why? Because the point is, with relatively little, you can create an ecosystem that grossly changes the day-to-day economics of a site, of a village, of a town sometimes. In DRC, we're looking at towns of over 1 million people. So it's not quite the little village that you might have in mind, right? And the point is that most of these people, let's just say the bulk of the economic output is agriculture related, and it's at the, you know, at the lower end of the value addition. So people will paradoxically, you know, plant maize, sell maize, and buy flour, right? Whereas with the mill, you can process the flour, right? And the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, it is a large investment. It is a long-term investment. But from the very get-go, you can substantially change how much these clients save and how much they make with more value addition. And I'm talking at factors of 3 to 5 in the first year. So you're looking at a customer, you, for example, in the UK, you represent, I would say, something like a £300 sterling value for the next, I don't know who your power company is, but as a competitor, I'd be willing to spend about that much to steal you away, right? And that's kind of the value, the going value. Maybe today it's a bit more because power prices have gone through the roof in Europe, right? But here it's a little bit different, right? If you're looking at rural Uganda or DRC, you're really looking at, you know, $3 to $4 a month for selling electricity to a client, which is by no means high, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you realize that the investments we're making, and not just electricity, not just water purification, but processing and ultimately economic value addition, you can multiply what the basket of savings, of liquidity of those customers is in the first year or two, and you're operating a 20-year asset. So our game is not to build a business plan based on today's consumption for 20 years, but it's built along, do as much as we can to improve the economics of that site, to improve ultimately the lives of these customers, because that's what's the original motivation, William, is we wanted to make a change, make a difference, right? And that's why we're all here. But ultimately, we need to run a business. And so we've found this beautiful synergy, a communion of interest towards do more for the community. And as the community grows, you're able to provide more services. So what in jargon is called the ARPU, the average revenue per user, can be multiplied across the first 2 years. Right. And then you have a residual asset life and concession of, say, 18 out of the 20, right? Where now you're making a lot more money and the community is developing much, much faster. And that's really our business. It's how do we galvanize, how do we catalyze the local economy thanks to energy-enabled infrastructure? Perhaps I'll pause there.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Thank you for that detail. So that was going to be one of my questions. It is about who pays and how they pay for these developments. Because, you know, for people who aren't used to electricity access, I can imagine that their use is potentially pretty small and limited to necessities. If they have some kind of diesel genset, perhaps. So it sounds like part of the business model here is to offer them this access and then to kind of grow their use, kind of profit through that. And that simultaneously improves their quality of life by allowing them clean water and, you know, electric transport. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say, and you've touched a number of issues. So maybe I can brush across them quickly. So who pays? I mean, the customers pay through mobile phone enabled prepaid smart meters. So effectively it's a prepaid model, because that is that is a way to not incur credit risk and is, you know, a step towards bankability of the system, right? So prepaid the customers with the same way you'd prepay for your mobile phone or data, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. In terms of who finances the infrastructure, inevitably this sector is still nascent. So there's the, you know, we've benefited greatly from foundations and support such as the Shell Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and many others. Dune Foundation in the Netherlands has been of great help. There's many. And increasingly, there's a footprint of private investors. The paradox we're living is that this is infrastructure. And so big infrastructure funds want massive tickets and kind of lower returns in exchange for lower risk. Yeah. And the sector is not there yet. So our challenge is, how do we leverage sort of more expensive private equity or venture capital with the support of foundations until we build a business model, B, the credibility, and C, the portfolios that can attract the larger traditional infrastructure capital. But the good news is that there's already quite a bit of interest, and I don't think we're far from there. I would say we're 1 to 2 years away from really showing that this is sort of the last traditional infrastructure asset class to be completed, right? And then we can talk about supersonic trains and space travel. But if we stick to traditional infrastructure, this is the one big gap that I think we're together as sector peers on the verge of solving. And and so last thing to emphasize is that traditionally in sort of, you know, the West and China, the government has shouldered this cost, right? But here we're dealing in countries and in geographies where the national treasury doesn't have the firepower to be able to do that. But there is a willingness. And so inevitably, there's a very strong government role. The World Bank is playing its part. And now, one initiative that's worthy of note is the GAPS, the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet, which was founded by Rockefeller together with the Bezos Earth Fund and the IKEA Foundation. And that's $2 billion growing to $10 billion. But the point is, these guys have realized that, hey, we need to really put a lot of firepower in a concentrated way. And they're working with the World Bank and governments to really get the scale off the ground. And the point is, inevitably, we're on the cusp, if you will, of private entrepreneurship and public service, really. Hmm. And so that's an added complication that we've learned to deal with and has finally come to the point where we're really seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of getting the right political buy-in, the right amount of public funding in order to deliver assets with an affordable tariff. And so a little bit long-winded way to say that the financing mix of these infrastructures is rather diverse and it should be, because it's, you cannot 100% commercially finance these sites today unless you're willing to charge exorbitant tariffs. And so remember, this is, to us, it's a 20-year plus play. Effectively, we're in the business of transforming hitherto poor rural customers and what we believe will be the next set of middle-class customers. And again, to touch the last point perhaps that I missed from your question is, people can afford to pay electricity. They can already, whether it's the national grid or maybe extending its lines or whether it's a mini grid. But oftentimes, they do not have the liquidity to buy assets with which to further benefit. So whether it's a fridge or an electric pressure cooker. Mm. And that's where the partnerships with Energrow and the like are essential, because people need to make money from electricity, to benefit from electricity beyond just lighting and a cost, right? Yeah. And I think that's the ethos here. So we think that electricity and then the ecosystem is a way, as you said, to improve people's lives, but also to create a new customer class, which will be interesting for a plethora of service offering.
Yeah, I see. So electricity on its own is worth not very much. You need a fridge to keep your food cool so that you can save money on that. You need water purification, etc.
Correct.
Great. Yeah. So I wondered if you could go in kind of moving from talking about this stuff in kind of theory and abstracted slightly. I wondered if you could talk about some of your projects, where they are and what they've done and how successful they've been.
Absolutely. So I think I'll start by the end. So the word success is always a bit scary as an energy access entrepreneur. I don't think any of us feel success as such, not yet anymore, but I will tell you about about what we've struggled to accomplish. So Equatorial Power, so far, we've been able to deploy 5 assets, one with ENGIE in Uganda, which is sort of our flagship, and we're very proud of it. It's an island in Lake Victoria called Lolwe, where we've really rolled out our productive use model. So this is, you know, traditionally a mini grid is 20 to 50 kilowatt size. This is 600 kilowatts, connects 5 different villages, you know, close to 4,000 connections. We have a big industrial park, or as we call it, a productive hub that does water purification, industrial scale ice making for fish preservation, fish drying and other processing. And we're now rolling out very interesting electric mobility pilot, which was backed by the UK government, and it's looking extremely good so far. So we think we can replicate not just two-wheelers, but electric fishing boats, right? So we've really built an ecosystem there. And as I said, together with Energro doing the asset financing, we are truly bringing this to the next level, where we've seen our customers now doing much more, right? Affording much more. And so that's Lolwe. And we have a pipeline, I would say, of close to 50 islands we're targeting on Lake Victoria, of which the next 10 are nearing financial close. So that's with ENGIE. Then on the mainland in Uganda, we have a partnership with Umeme, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, now GIAP, the fund I just spoke about, where we are piloting an interconnection model between a mini grid and the national grid to work in collaboration in order to accelerate energy access. This is the Utility 2.0 project, and we are looking at potentially scaling that up. So that's the 2 assets in Uganda. We have a 3rd asset in Rwanda, and then 2 more in DRC. Now, DRC is also very interesting because there's a UK government-backed and other government-backed fund called Africa Infraco. And with them, we are nearing financial close for a scale-up on in the eastern province of DRC, Lake Kivu. There's a big island with 350,000 people on it called Ijwi. We've built 2 sites, and we're ready to roll out another 15 together with this funding. And that's about 2 months away from, I hope, beginning. We've worked hard at it. And then with the Congolese government and a few potential partners, we've spent the last 3 months. My teams have been in, you know, the thickest of the central DRC and the western DRC. And we've been looking at villages, towns, and cities, real cities, you know, with airports, but all genset powered, right? I'm talking 1.5 million people and no electricity. Wow. And we've been developing these projects because we think that from this year, we can begin with a much bigger rollout. So taking our concept of Lolwe, like with a productive hub, and applying it to a bigger setting. And we really think that, you know, we're inspired by ENGIE, we're inspired by NL, NLX, and other European companies that are electrifying the economy. And we think we can apply the same exact thing to these more rural or peri-urban settings in a successful manner. And so what's exciting is we're currently on the cusp of sort of breaking ground on this type of larger project. And we hope that by COP in November, we'll be able to exhibit some real game-changing results. And so yeah, 5 operational assets. We have about 5,500 customers, smart metered customers, right? And we have about 30 more mini grids nearing financial close that we will roll out this year. But the hope is that we really step up to much bigger projects as of the end of this year. And that's really our target.
Yeah. So I'm interested as to what unites or what there is in common between these areas that you're developing and that you have developed. Are these all areas where there are population centers who are currently not served in terms of kind of centralized power? Is that what unites them?
Correct. I mean, that's we start from areas that have no access to electricity as such, beyond maybe a couple of gensets. In DRC, some of the sites do have access to some electricity, but it's very expensive and very sporadic. So yes, that is the first unification point. The second is we target areas that have some kind of latent productive potential. So whether they be fishing villages or trading hubs, right, where we can not only provide power, but through a bit of processing and asset financing, we can quickly accelerate the local economy in terms of both savings and value addition. And that's really the key here for us. And, you know, we started from the sort of island vertical because we find that fishing villages both have more income, but they also need a lot of ice to preserve fish. And, yeah. and ice making is actually a natural battery. That's how you should see it. So in terms of an energy system, it boosts the economics quite substantially. Now we've ventured into more fully rural settings with different value chains, but we really learned our trade on fishermen and ice. And the truth and the trick for us is, with all this complexity, is to try and simplify and stick to one vertical, try and get it right, and then explore new ones. I mean, we are learning by doing, right? I think we've had tremendous progress over the last 5 years, but there's still a lot to learn, honestly. And we're excited by the journey.
That's great. So you talk about ice as a kind of natural battery, which is a really interesting way to look at it. What technologies are you using that directly generate the electricity? Is it solar, and therefore you need the ice to be generated during the day when when the sun is out, or are there other technologies?
No, that's a good observation. So generally speaking, we use solar with storage. So we use lithium ion for batteries generally. Okay. We're looking at a couple of hydro sites. Of course, if there's an opportunity for a hydro, especially a small hydro, it is very interesting because generally cheaper over the lifetime of the asset. But otherwise, basic model is solar with storage. But for example, just to give you an idea, I mean, when you have a fishing village and there are peak, just like in the UK, just like in Rome where I'm from, right? I mean, there are peak times where people consume more power, either because of industrial use or household uses. Same thing on a village, right? And that means that if you want to serve them throughout the day, you have to size a system so as to be able to cater to these peaks, sometimes with a diesel generator or whatever is required to keep the system cost lower, right? Because you don't want to overcharge for the power, right? So there's a lot of competing considerations. But ultimately, you know that you're going to have a system which, in order to serve the peak hours, will be too big for the rest of the day, right? So generally, it's early morning and then evening times. And evening time not always coincides with sunshine, right? So sometimes there's still a bit of sun, other times there isn't. And you have to cater that with storage. But what I'm getting at is that generally, a solar mini-grid asset will have waste. There'll be times during the day when your batteries are fully loaded and consumption is not high enough, and therefore you are wasting electrons, right? Which, what that means financially is that there's a loss. There is a lower return on that investment than you could otherwise have. So what we're doing is, by producing ice, for example, in a fishing village, we're able to use that excess power to produce more ice. Obviously, it's stored in cold rooms and sold later, for example, and we would turn these machines off during peak hour. So overall, we have a system which is much more efficiently sized, and fundamentally, we are able to much better control supply and demand. So when you correlate your supply and demand curve, you have better efficiencies economically. Ultimately, you can charge a lower tariff and make higher returns. And that's the beauty of this model.
Yeah. So it's essentially like running a fridge through the night, except that there's no sun during the night. So you create the ice in the day and then cool the fish through the night with the ice.
Something like that as well. I mean, for us, it's we can store the ice and then they can buy it. The point being, when do we use the energy? We can't control when the sun shines. Yeah. So we have to maximize the sort of cheapest source, which is the sunshine, and transform that into something that can be sold later, like ice. And then that also enables us not to turn on these machines in the evening hours when it would be much more expensive, because now it's solar power converted into batteries and then reconverted for use. So there's a lot of investment to make that happen, right? And so these sound like tremendously small and obvious tweaks, but in terms of economics of the system, it changes a lot. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we think we are on the way to solving. But again, it's a game of inches. Like, there's not one solution that fixes everything. There's many iterations and many different things that together can offer a viable solution for your customers while also offering a decent return for investors willing to take on this path.
Yeah. So if most of the generation is solar, do you use any kind of time of day, cost of generation reflective pricing to incentivize demand to appear during the day when energy is potentially cheaper? Or do you keep it simple and use a kind of flat tariff on the energy?
That's an excellent question and good intuition, right? The answer is yes. We are exploring dynamic pricing, as you say, to continue to correlate the supply and demand curve. That's the obsession here. Generate more, but sell all of it, right? That's the point. So yes, we are. I mean, we started simple because this is also a heavily regulated industry and we have to work hand in hand with the regulator. And so simple is beautiful at first. And then you realize that you can iterate it. And we're now doing exactly what you hinted at. So I think that's the way forward. It's not only time of day pricing, but it's also type of use pricing. One example, if you want to run a machine for your business, you need to have availability of more capacity. And you don't want to have the problem that your neighbor's, you know, blasting a stereo and so you can't turn on your machine, right? And so as a power provider with limited amount of generation, we have to create incentives and sometimes disincentives so that all the machines we want to operate can operate, perhaps at different times, but can operate, right? Other machines, for example, need a lot of power to start up, but then don't need that power going forward. So one of the things we're learning and we're doing is selecting machinery that doesn't have such spikes because, again, for a mini grid, that's more difficult to cater to than for a, sort of a national system. But we're getting there. I mean, honestly, we've made tremendous strides forward in balancing the system. And I think there's a lot. For the first time, I think we have lessons to export back to Europe. And I think the most exciting link for me as a, you know, I used to be a lawyer, right? So as a English qualified lawyer and a European finance lawyer, I think there's a huge opportunity in Europe today with the electrification of the economy going towards community usage. So getting just taking weight off the national grid, which will now have to cater to charging infrastructure and all other things, right? So the creation of energy communities across Europe, which by the way is an EU regulation. I know the UK will probably do its own thing, but the point is there'll be incentives in place for communities, whether that's small municipalities or just agglomerations of houses or, you know, and the trick there is balance of system, i.e. correlating that local supply. So whatever solar you install, you've got to try and use within that community because that maximizes your output. And that's what we've, by necessity, have become experts at in this sector. So honestly, it's exciting to know that for the first time in a while, we think we're able to export knowledge that could be useful for Europe's energy transition.
That sounds like a landmark point to realize that you've kind of moved on to, and that's really brilliant. I wonder where you see Equatorial Power being in 5, 10, 20 years. You know, it's in its relative nascency, and I would imagine that you see huge potential for it. You quoted some kind of population statistics, you know, people underserved by traditional sort of reliable access electricity in the African market. So do you see this huge market going forwards and plenty of work for them, for your company in the next 20 years?
Absolutely, yes. Now, 20 years, you know, I don't think I've ever planned 20 years ahead, but certainly five. Sure. And what I could tell you is that there is a huge market, which is not so easy to serve. Part of the reason why it's unserved, right? Underserved is really a euphemism. It's just not served. So we are pioneering ways, particularly with others. I mean, we're not the only ones. There's other great companies out there. We are pioneering ways to serve these customers and therefore create a whole new pipeline of market. And it's massive, right? We're talking $300-400 billion of dollars of just mini grid energy infrastructure. Then if you slap on agro-processing and data, you're easily exceeding $1 trillion. If you look at African demographics, and we're just talking about Africa, but then there's Southeast Asia, Latin America, and you know, we could even explore further and and look at some of the quote unquote, you know, developed markets, which are not developing in terms of energy transition, right? So the market is huge. And the point is, you've got to see this as customers in Africa or Europe, they don't really care about electrons, right? I always make the joke, you can't see an electron, you can get electrocuted. That's your best bet in dealing with an electron, right? But the point is, you care about a service. And the servitization of the economy is understanding that and saying, doesn't matter how I bring you that service, but I will help you to turn on a light, to move from A to B, to process that fish, right? And when you do that, you realize that the customer is much happier and much happier to pay for whatever it is the customer needs, right? And that's the key. And it's all data and tech enabled. The reason why now we can see the world this way is because of the tremendous advancements in tech and data. So to go back to the question, I digress. The question was, right now in Africa, if you look at demographics, the population, you know, 1.2 billion people in Africa are set to double in the next 20 years, right? 25 years, which on one hand is scary. On the other hand, is a tremendous opportunity for development and for service offering. So that's our market. And yes, I think that, you know, being among the pioneers, we see it now in Uganda and DRC and other markets we've been exploring, that there are, you know, green pastures subject to us solving what, you know, has until today been a difficult problem to crack, but we're getting closer. And I will underscore that we tremendously value partnerships. Like, we can't go at this alone. There's a lot of sector learning. I mean, AMDA, the sort of sector organization, does a great job at keeping us all together. NG has been an amazing partner, and we think that the future is definitely tied to them in terms of scaling, in terms of leveraging each other's strengths, which are complementary, obviously. Without sounding unmodest, NG is NG, right? We're just a startup, but we have some complementarity, and that's a really valuable. And I think, I mean, they're really doing great things. I'm very proud of them. I wish other utilities and other majors would follow their example. But you know, Shell Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, without them, not only us, but most sector companies would be gone by now. So definitely a lot of gratitude there, and a big role for them in the near future. But also utilities, like Umeme has shown yet again leadership in terms of trying new business models. There is something to be said about the fact that, yes, we're talking about off-grid, unserved people, but one of the biggest markets is the edge or the fringe of grid, right? Where you extend lines, people are still relatively poor, they're still relatively underserved, they still need, they fit similar criteria to our further away off-grid customers. But the paradox is they have access to power. They're just not doing much with it. And so we see that as our future market as well. And so, yes, I think the future is bright. We just have to convince investors to take that outlook. A lot of them are already coming on board, which is great. But yeah, hopefully, Western investors see that there's tremendous opportunities in the electrification of the economy and the energy transition you know, in the US, in Europe. But those returns will always be somewhat limited. Whereas, you know, in emerging markets, you're taking a little bit more risk, but you are growing. It's not about the asset. It's about that customer growth. And you can get 20x growth on a customer that starts at a lower position. So the opportunity is frankly tremendous. And the beautiful thing, which I've already said, but to me is very important, it's the fundamental alignment between the development of a future-facing business and the socioeconomic development of that customer together. It's fully aligned. And I think that's powerful.
Yeah. I mean, the way you describe it sounds pretty perfect, that you kind of marry those two desirable, you know, ends together. So it sounds like really, really important work. I'm interested to hear what your journey was into energy in the first place. As you've mentioned, you're a lawyer by training. So what was the step into the world of energy from there?
Yep. Never an obvious transition, right? I mean, I was a finance attorney. So I did mainly structured finance, infrastructure funding, fund structuring. Not the most exciting stuff, certainly educational. I did that for about 5 years in Italy and the UK and a little bit in emerging markets. But I realized that wasn't my true calling. I did learn a lot. I mean, from, I can speak from my perspective, right? As a lawyer dealing with regulated industries, that was probably the biggest learning, because moving into energy, energy is heavily regulated. It does require a long-term outlook. It does require a degree of sophistication in dealing with investors and governments. So I would honestly, without my legal background, this transition would have been a lot harder for me anyway. There was many things that came quite natural. Of course, I didn't know much about the energy space. I took a keen interest and you know, read up on it. But I remember when I switched, that this was about 2013, I wanted to just do renewables, right? Just large scale renewables. But then I realized immediately that there was this whole market of unserved customers that, thanks to a bunch of macros, right? Technology advancement, price points of solar, for example, and capital yield dropping in Europe, there's an opportunity now to attack this market and do good. And to me, the perfect crossroads was, can I use my fundamentally capital markets and infrastructure funding knowledge to do good for people as well? And that was the perfect marriage for me. And the transition was, again, I mean, I leveraged what I knew, and I tried to surround myself with people far, far better and more intelligent than me and more savvy in the energy space. And in so doing, I had a few opportunities present themselves. Ultimately, William, it takes just proactivity, right? And you learn, and many things that today I would do differently. But I also was lucky to be presented with certain opportunities that I was able to grasp, and it took time. And you know, here we are, quite a number of years later, and you know, I get to speak from a point of expertise on a nascent sector. But it took a transition, and I don't think I could have done it quicker. But it does take a few years. So I suppose, for anybody looking at the energy sector with interest, it is a big behemoth, right? But increasingly, it touches more parts of our lives today, and it will continue to do so. So I suppose the message is, there is space for everyone from any walk of life, from any professional background, as long as you have the interest and the perseverance to learn. But just to close, there are many areas that are nascent today where there is really no expertise, and so. Sure, you could get into the track of the old school energy infrastructure financing, which you know is a nicely beaten road. But there's also frontier markets and nascent business models in developed or developing countries that present plenty of opportunities in space. And it's much more accessible than I think you think when you're outside, right? And the last thing is, if you look at my team, a lot of people were sort of somehow savvy about electricity, but a lot of people weren't, and they bring a tremendous addition to that. In fact, I would say that's the biggest value is bringing people from different areas, yeah, and just aggregating, right? So, So honestly, this is a sector which is continuing to expand and will only grow, and needs thinkers from many different aspects of life. And then we're really on a wave of innovation. My invitation is open to anybody to have a chat with. I'm always open to chat because you learn every day. I learn something.
Yeah. That's a really good summary. I think that's probably an important part to draw out, is that yes, energy is huge, and it can kind of seem insurmountable, but actually that's just because it touches everyone's life. There are more jobs under the umbrella of energy than you could ever possibly imagine. And therefore, a necessity for all sorts of skills as well, whether it be lawyers, financiers, technical experts, you name it, it'll probably be there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure to have you, Ricardo. I'm afraid we've run out of time, so we'll have to wrap it up. But thank you so much for joining me. This was a really interesting conversation, and I have the utmost respect for what you're doing. I think it's really smart, it's really savvy, and it's noble as well. So I hope it keeps going well, and I'll be watching with a keen interest to see how Equatorial Power and all your other interests that you do so much that we haven't really gotten into half of what you do. But I'll be watching with a keen interest.
Thank you so much, William. I really appreciate your words. And thanks for having me on your show.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you.